Hello and welcome to Cruising Through History. I'm sitting down here with the wonderful Scott Cruz. Scott, where are we cruising through today?
Well, Xander, today I thought I'd talk about knights and knighthood.
Well, and we're talking K-N knights.
Yes.
And not starting with an N, but knights as in swords and shields, kings.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, we've talked a little bit about this subject when we talked about dragons and when we talked about King Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, you know, there's a whole world that surrounds knights and knighthood and that kind of thing.
Indeed, especially in literature. And you know, whenever you bring up something, it's literature, I'm going to be chiming in a lot. So I guess we'll start with what are knights? Like, what are we considering knights?
They were basically, in the beginning, they were basically, they were normally nobles because you had to have a horse. Mm-hmm. It was kind of the thing. And it really started during the 8th century. Charlemagne, who was the king of the Franks, when he would go on his missions or he'd go to conquer other territory, he would always bring these other people along, but they were on horses. They weren't like infantry. They didn't march.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just sort of, and then he would repay them by giving them land. And then just through this sort of thing that was going on, so they would be called fiefs. They became like the lord's vassals. And then in another Frankish emperor named Charles the Bold, he actually made these lands hereditary. So now knights were becoming part of the nobility because they were also inheriting land. And that's how this kind of slowly started, you know. And the Franks would also call to arms men who had horses when they had to fight the Vikings because the Vikings were invading Frankish lands in like the late 10th century, 11th century. And so it sort of evolved from there. Now, what we think of a knight now, that came later. The full armor. In the beginning, it was just guys on horses.
Real okay. So it really, knighthood as a whole, first of all, probably wasn't known as knights at that time.
Right.
It was more about who had land and who would be called upon for battle.
Basically. And then what happened is when you became a vassal, this was basically a lord's army in some ways. That's why knights sort of had this reputation in the beginning as being sort of brutish and sort of inspiring terror in people because, you know, not a lot of people had horses, especially, you know, the poor peasants didn't have horses.
And horses in warfare especially were devastating to have.
Yes.
Compared to infantry.
Yes. And so it isn't until later you start getting the whole code of chivalry and that kind of stuff starts to take place.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the knights, there was a book called The Song of Roland, which was published like in 1100, that really the main character, Roland, this was in Great Britain, he was sort of the ideal knight. He was, you know, he had the whole thing of gentility and all this stuff, all these knightly virtues that we think of now when we think of knights. And so, and the whole code of chivalry, that kind of would sort of merge with religion. And that's where you get like the Christian knight, you know, protecting churches. And,
or something close to Templars even.
Yes, yes. And that's how that started. And I think about when the First Crusade was called in 1095, you know, a lot of these liege lords who went, well, they would always have these battles and they were concerned about their soul because of all the killing they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Pope Urban, he kind of thought, this is a good way to, he said, well, if you fight in the crusade, you'll get absolution because you'll be a, you know, Christian soldier. And so that's how that came. And then you even had these redoubts in Syria and in the Middle East because of the Crusades, like the Knights Hospitallers and the Knights Templars. So, but really that's how it starts to go. And that's how you start to get it. Now the whole armor thing doesn't come to about the 12th century. If you ever seen the movie Braveheart,
I may have at some
point. Well, at the end, there's a scene with Robert the Bruce when he's going to lead. This is after William Wallace has been executed by the British, and he's going to lead Wallace's troops into battle. Well, he's wearing like chainmail and that, and that's what kind of what knights wore. In fact, I have a book in front of me called The Knight in History, and he's wearing what a crusader knight would have worn, and none of it's armor. It's like chainmail with a cloth or some kind of material over it.
Yeah, we're not talking plate armor. Chainmail has been a
thing. Yes,
it's chainmail. Not plate armor.
Not plate armor. That comes more like during the Hundred Years' War,
when
you'd get the plate armor and the full panoply of you know, the helmet with the mask and all that good stuff. And, you know, the big lance.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's interesting you say lance. I was thinking this whole time that knights seem to be tied to money and influence. And the thing is, like, swords are expensive.
Yes.
And also, and contrary to, like, popular belief, swords were not, like, the peak of warfare. That would be the lance or the spear or the pike.
Yes.
The images in the books that you have shows a knight in that chainmail cloth over it and a lance with a flag.
Yes.
So that would be more indicative of what they would be using rather than, at this point, a sword.
Right. And it was, it's funny, it's interesting that you say that because the cost of it will play into the demise of the knight later on.
Ooh, okay.
So, but yeah, you're right. It was very costly to be a knight, which is why really only nobles were knights.
So
there was very rare circumstances where someone would be knighted, a commoner, because of some extraordinary military thing they did or something.
But nowadays, we see stories that are all the time of like the commoner or the poor who, through sheer military might, then gets knighted. But what you're saying is that was
the exception, not the rule. Yeah, it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the times, these were nobility. And then the children of nobility, since these were hereditary, would follow in their father's footsteps, if you will.
Ah, so then those story, and I always bring this back to stories and movies and film and stuff. We see a lot of, you know, following the father's footsteps to protect the land and all that jazz. That's kind of in line with how knighthood would have been, because then having a son would mean, oh, they would probably be a knight. I'm guessing there weren't a lot of women as knights at the time.
Not that I'm aware of. Now, there could have been, because we always see this in war, where females will be soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just sort of hide it. We've seen this in, the Civil War, all these other things.
And, yeah.
Well, Joan of Arc, I mean, she always wore the knight.
Full armor.
The full armor. I mean, at least the descriptions we have of her.
But still, so family still mattered a lot. Who takes over the land, it's very much small lordships that we think about rather than what we typically think about with knighthood, but they're really kind of.
And it's really interesting, the whole notion of chivalry. You know, I always saw it as, you know, you inculcate these values that you should have. Well, one of the biggest ones was loyalty to your liege lord.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you sort of had to have these rules to keep everyone sort of together and not getting out of hand.
Yeah.
Because, you know, these knights weren't all perfect. We think of them that. We always think of, you know, the gallant King Arthur and, you know. But some of them weren't. Like I said, they were a little brutal sometimes. And so you almost had to have these rules to keep everyone going, you know, keep everyone in line.
Well, I think that's something Game of Thrones is really good at. And for for keeping it, the reality of being a knight and brutality in line with what you're seeing in the history here.
Right. And originally, when you first had knights, or what we'd call knights, the church and clerics were sort of against them because of that.
Mm-hmm.
They thought they needed to reform. And then later on was when you had the sort of the melding with religion and chivalry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you got sort of the crusading knight. But it's from an old English word, the word knight, called knit. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's C-N-I-H-T, so if I've got it wrong. Of course, the whole time I'm doing this, I'm thinking of Monty Python. You know, we are this Lord, you know, we are the knights who say neat, but they were saying knit. I don't know what. I'm sorry, this is just a thing I'm going off on. But yeah, and it was from an old Germanic word, connect or necked.
Mm-hmm.
And so the word originally meant boy or male or servant. That's all it meant. It evolved over time to mean that.
I see.
To mean like a, you know, to a military superior, like, you were a servant to the military superior.
It's interesting that the phrase came, origins are Germanic, when really this started with French, with Charlemagne. Interesting how that got co-opted into England and the term knight.
Because really a lot of times when we think of knights, we do think of the English.
Mm-hmm. But it's really a French origin.
Yes.
Huh.
And even many of the knights who fought in the Crusades were French. Geoffrey of Bouillon and Robert of Tancred. Maybe it was Robert because it's French. And so these guys were nobility, but they're also knights. I often wonder how many wounds these guys sustained. Even with the armor,
well,
it must have been a hard life.
Yeah, and I mean, chainmail is pretty good, but more slashes than necessarily like piercing, which spears and lances
are
more known for piercing.
Well, even, you know, the battles were brutal, but even their tournaments were brutal, which were sort of the, I don't know if you have an equivalent, a modern day equivalent.
Jousting might be, is jousting what you're kind of thinking of here? Yeah.
The tournaments were usually put on, again, for nobility, usually for a royal wedding or something like that. You'd have these tournaments to celebrate something. But you'd have these things that were called melees, and this is where I think we get the word from, where you'd have 100 knights fight each other, and the last one standing won. I mean...
Like standing as an alive or like knocked out?
I think knocked out.
Okay.
Although in the early days of knighthood... they would have duels if you insulted somebody, or you would have trial by combat.
So those, another thing that we see a lot in like different stories and tales, duels, trials by combat, insulting your heritage or your father or something like
right.
that. That was
your liege lord or what have you. And sometimes in those duels, whoever was left standing would win. But in earlier times, they would execute whoever lost. So, I mean, you really had a... shall I say, reason to try to win.
And those things are more like, you know, a knight would use a sword for something like a duel rather than their lance.
Right, yes. And then, you know, even jousting, you know, you have the lance. Even when you look at that, I always think of the Renaissance Fair.
Yes.
Our local Renaissance Fair when they have jousting. Of course, you know, no one's killed in it, but in the original jousting, that was the whole point. You either hit the guy over the head or tried to dehorse him. That was the whole... And sometimes you would run them through with the lance.
Yeah, and I mean, shields are wonderful things, but you're still, you know, charging. It's like, you know, if you have two cars driving at 40 miles an hour on the opposite way, it's really a combined 80 miles per hour impact with the horses charging. Even if you have a shield, you're still taking a lot of force.
Yes, and that was the whole point, was to knock someone off their horse or just crack them over the head with your lance and maybe they would fall off.
And yeah, and the thing is, the jousting we see at like Renaissance fairs, they're for entertainment, not honor, or there isn't pride on the line necessarily. And maybe I'm completely wrong and someone can correct me, that's like, no, there's a whole jousting community with these things. But I can imagine as lords, you're also making a point about your land, about who your family is, or your son is better than their son. And, you know, you may gain more land, more loyalty by winning these sorts of things.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Game of Thrones, because look at the things that happened in there when someone broke their word. You know, that was sort of disastrous for all involved. And because you had insulted a family's honor, and that you had to address that, or else... you would appear weak in your kingdom.
And you could have duels to rectify the scenario.
Right. I mean, there was a reason these things were in place. And of course, we always equate the castles with the sort of the knight as well and that whole thing. But it was later when they actually had a, you know, there was actually a step, you know, they had like little steps to become a knight.
Okay.
Which I wasn't sure. I didn't realize that for some of them. There was always knightly training, and usually it was a child of the nobility, well, a male, could have been female, and up to age seven. At age seven, they were actually given to the lords of a castle for education and for and for martial skills being trained in those things.
So it would be like becoming a squire, or what we think of a squire. Yes.
The first level was a page.
Ah.
And then you would assist an older knight in battle, mm-hmm. carry his baggage, get the weapons, that kind of thing. But then at the age of 14 is when they would become squires.
Okay.
And then it would sort of be like advanced training. And I couldn't, some of the things that they had to be proficient in, these were considered prerequisite skills for knighthood. They were called agilities. One was riding, swimming and diving, shooting different types of weapons. Now, when they say shooting, they must mean like crossbows and
crossbows, arrows.
Yeah, there weren't any guns yet or firearms. Climbing, participation in tournaments, wrestling, fencing, long jumping, and the one I like the most, dancing.
Ooh, interesting.
It's interesting dancing comes up because it came up somewhere else where I was reading this. And I'm not sure because all of these were performed wearing armor. So I'm like, what is this? Are you dancing with a sword? I don't know what the dancing part's for.
It's
almost like boxing.
Well, that's where I was going to mention.
Fast on your feet are there.
Doing all of these in armor. So armor isn't necessarily light, but it's not necessarily super heavy.
Right.
Like knights in generally, they're very mobile.
Yes.
As a whole, even when plate armor was a thing, you still have a lot of mobility. It's not that restricting. Right. Or like the idea is like you're stiff in armor like that. So dance would actually be a great way to build your mobility, the idea that you can move around. But it's also interesting because they're becoming nobility. I'm assuming there would be balls or galas that knights would be expected to attend as well.
Yes.
So that actually, it makes a lot of sense, but it's very different from all the other things that they're being trained on
here. Right. And the first, there's two things I thought of. You know, when I was thinking of the tournaments, I was thinking of gladiatorial games,
mm-hmm.
sort of similar, kind of, you know, fighting each other. But when I thought of this, and with you saying the dancing and having these other skills, I always thought, well, if you ever looked at like the gentry in colonial America, like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, they were expected to know how to dance, play, you know, Jefferson played the violin. So they're expected to have these other skills besides just the, you know.
Yeah, they can't just be brutish and as a whole. They have to know, they have to be keep up culturally somehow.
Right. And and exactly. Washington and Jefferson weren't like brutish knights, but I was comparing it to just the nobility.
Yeah.
Or what we'd consider upper class.
Well, I would think that knights wouldn't want to just be known for slaying their enemies. They would want to be known as skilled people, skilled scholars or dancers or something else.
Right. And a lot of the knightly literature that came out where we were introduced, there's something called The Matters of France, which is a piece of literature that introduced us to Charlemagne. And his retinue were called paladins. That's interesting. I didn't know that's where that word came from.
Yeah, that is a word. So I'm most familiar with that word in video games. So I'm interested. So go on with about how this happened.
Well, in the Matters of Britain, which was another thing, that's where we met King Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
But we also met King Arthur in Geoffrey of Monmouth's book when we were talking about dragons.
Yeah.
And whether it was history or not, or not. So these legends just built up, and that's where we got that whole chivalry. You know, we still say, if someone chivalry and chivalrous, we still talk about that now.
Mm-hmm.
I think we equate those two. But it was really interesting how you had the rules, you had these steps you had to take to become. And then when you were, the knighting ceremony was called an accolade, and that was usually done over a sword with someone who was religious, like a priest or something present. Yep.
And I mean, knighting still is a thing, especially in England.
Yes.
Being knighted and becoming a sir or man or lady something, that still happens.
Yeah, the Order of the British Empire, I believe it's called, the OBE, mm-hmm. as they call it. And a lot of these knightly groups are still around. They're more religious now than martial, of course. We're not going to be afraid the Knights Templar are going to come back and, no matter what Dan Brown might think, but you know.
So knights as a whole really have developed from, they kind of went in a different way than I expect. They went from kind of more military-esque fighting powers that were then rewarded with land to more of a cultural piece that also had some, you know, martial prowess, but gained right. more and then added more controls and chivalry.
Right.
And that's a lot of our stories come from that aspect. And the whole, you know, page to squire to knight, I mean, we still see that in shows. We still see that referenced in a lot of right. books.
The Sword in the Stone, I think the story is the young kid pulls the sword out of the rock.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's true. And and even later on, the term itself, knight, it went from meaning a military connotations to just meaning someone who was part of the nobility or a landholder. They didn't have to necessarily be military.
Yeah.
So like you said, that's how that phrase evolved to become just part of a noble title, if you will, you know. And I think you even see this, a knight of Malta, a knight of this, a knight of that. And that's what that kind of became. So that was a good point.
Sometimes I've got that insight. You know, it happens every so often. So I guess my thought is we've really focused on Europe for a lot of this idea of knighting, knighthood, and such.
Right.
I guess outside of Europe, was there something similar when it comes to knights or
knighthood? There were in the Islamic world, there were mounted military people on horses.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of they were called Faricia. I hope I said that right. And I think that's some of the comparison there. And of course, we think of samurais too.
Yeah, that samurai was one of the areas because it's essentially the same. Well, forgive me, my Japanese history isn't that great. Similar things.
No, it's very similar because, you know, the samurai, it was almost even more extreme. Like, you remember, you couldn't really address someone or they would cut you down or, you know, because they were on a horse. Again, you know, the horse is very, in those early days of warfare, and I think of Braveheart again, you know, horses are very, it's a very psychological weapon.
Mm-hmm.
When you have like 100 or 200 or 500 horses bearing down on you, that's a lot of noise.
And horses, we're specifically talking about like war horses, which different breeds of horses have different musculature, different
yes.
sizes. They're not like racing horses that are going to be that lean.
Right. And remember, a lot of the horses even wore the same kind of colors because knights would have colorful banners. This would be for heraldry.
And armor.
And they would armor the horses too. But yeah, there's a story from 15th century Spain, a knight there, and he had horses for different reasons. I mean, he had some horses he trained for warfare, some horses he trained for tournaments, and some horses he trained for parades. So they had different types of horses. It's interesting you said that because I was just reading about this before we came in here. But they had different types of horses even for specific things. And you're right, because war horses are totally different than a draft horse.
Yeah.
Because they have to have different skills.
Temperament. You
know, temperament. Because you got to have a horse that can go into battle with all that noise. And then when you had guns, when firearms were introduced, you had to have a horse that would stay.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't bolt.
Even then, I'm reading a manga called Kingdom. It's been going on for 13 plus years. And even horses in there, it's almost like the horses have an ego like the soldiers they're carrying, especially
yes.
if they've been around for a while. Like, they sense that their master has is potentially losing. They don't want to lose. They want to win.
Right.
And they'll help. They'll keep going until they die, essentially.
Right, right. And the horse part is very interesting. In fact, maybe we'll do another podcast in the future just on horses in history, because you're right. They have their own temperaments.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to train them to do all those things. So the horse becomes integral. And really, the horse is a great psychological weapon, too, I always thought.
Tactically as well.
Yeah.
Being able to move that quickly is...
Right.
And
right.
the soldier themselves not be as tired, as well as they're very good with lances, spears, glaives,
Yeah.
Horses go really well with those.
And unfortunately, you know, a lot of times, and well, when you had groups of knights fighting the heavy cavalry, you know, one of the things was to take down the horse.
Yep.
Because you got to knock the guy off the horse. And so that's one way to do it.
So really, across cultures, having a horse was the thing that made a lot of military might, made knights, samurai, the phrase you use in the Middle East, I forgot the term.
It's Farisea, but I think I'm saying it wrong.
I mean, yeah.
We probably are. It's like my French. I'm sure I'm pronouncing things wrong whenever I speak French.
Yeah. So really, it comes down to money again.
Yes.
Which is a lot of this, is being able to have money can get you the equipment, the horse, the training.
Yes.
To really do all this, until later on when there are systems that, okay, we can have start at page and make your way up,
right,
or be sent, or you're some nobles who isn't a military scholar, and like, I'm going to send my son to become a page so that they can maybe be a knight.
And it really starts to end in the 16th century, about the mid-1500s, when they start introducing firearms to the battlefield.
Yeah.
And then what happens is, these liege lords and then countries themselves, the kings, and that figure out you don't need to spend all this money supporting knights,
mm-hmm,
because you can. It's easier to train infantry now because if they have firearms of some kind,
doesn't matter.
And of course, a firearm can knock off a knight off his horse, even with his armor,
or
just kill the horse. Because unfortunately,
firearms will pierce through armor.
Yes, and there was a battle in 1477 called the Battle of Nancy, which is in France. That I pronounced right. But anyway, where a group of French heavy cavalry were defeated by Swiss pikemen because the pikes were longer, so they could just stand on it.
Yep.
And then stab upward.
Get through where there
were openings in the metal.
Pikes in particular were a infantry strategy to have large tower shields with pikes,
right?
And there are different formations that could break a horse charge.
Yes,
they kind of there and stack them. And if you have three men behind you holding that shield and holding the pike, I mean, you better hope the pike breaks rather than anything else. You're not getting through that.
And it's really interesting that once knights are gone, and it's more of a state function to have military troops,
mm-hmm,
it still lives on. I mean, we think of cavalry.
Yep.
Even cavalry. I mean, they were heavy cavalry because they were armored.
Or even the term cavalry.
I mean, in Vietnam, there was the air cav. They were, mm-hmm, called cavalry. But they flew in helicopters.
Yep.
So the notion of a cavalry lived on, even though there were no more horses.
Yep.
And so, and our fascination with knighthood is still around. I mean, Hitler would give people the Knight's Cross in World War II as a military decoration. We talked about, you know, these orders that are still around, mm-hmm, the OBE, Knights of Columbus. It's an insurance. I mean, they even used the term knights.
Yeah.
So the imagery is still with us.
And it really, I mean, this imagery isn't limited to Europe, because the concept of samurai is still something that's big in as well. It's still
right, and
there.
they fought under a code of honor,
mm-hmm,
just like Western knights did.
Had land. Really,
very feudal. I mean, there were land, and there were the peasants, and so
really, this concept of the noble warrior really sticks with us for. Well, summary. I mean, we like the idea of. And I'm saying this, maybe this is a human thing, or maybe it's a specific culture. We like the idea that the people fighting have some form of nobility to them.
Right.
Or that they have a code that they follow to justify or defend, something like that.
And even samurai, you know, if they actually dishonored themselves in some way, there was hara-kiri, which we saw in World War II. A lot of the military people in Japan did that.
Yeah.
I mean, they were still acting that out. So like I said, the imagery and the notions of knighthood are still with us. Of course, all those ruined castles are all over Europe too, so that doesn't hurt.
Now, having that history right there, I mean, we don't think of the Americas in knighthood. Like that's
No, we're totally different. There's no castles. Well, there's rich people's houses, but
yeah, it's the way that the US has been. It's just that never was a thing. We had firearms were a thing, so knights would have naturally died out for the most part as a military thing.
Right, and right, exactly, because as firearms even got more advanced, and that was the end of knighthood because it was cheaper to just arm the...
Rather than train a horse, train a page.
But it's funny how it evolved from these notions of these nobility, this noble warrior and all this, to calling, you know, you had generals in the 17th and 18th century calling their armies rabble and scum and, you know, the dregs of society. So it's funny when you got a mass army and you got these total war battles.
Yeah.
When you started drafting the people, like Napoleon did, his armies were famous for being known as that, that this whole notion changed because it got bigger.
Yeah.
Not everybody could be a knight.
No, and... I mean, that I guess that's been a thing forever. Not everyone can be a knight, or you know, your dreams of knighthood should be crushed, something like that. I mean, that's the inspiration for the stories we see today, as people want to become something greater.
Yes.
And speaking of greater, we always have to keep going to our next site on our cruise. So, Scott, where are we cruising through next time?
Well, Xander, next time it's going to be kind of special. We're going to have a passenger with us cruising down the road of history.
Oh, a little backseat driver. Okay.
Yes, and we're going to talk about the Great Famine in China during the Great Leap Forward.
All right. I will look forward to that then.
Oh, hey, Scott, did you know that listeners can actually contact us now?
They can. How can they do that?
Yeah, they can just email us at historycruise@mykpl.info.
Great. Also, like and subscribe on any of the platforms you find this podcast.